Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our speaker today is Rafi Khachaturian, who has been on the editorial staff of the New Yorker magazine since 2003. Earlier this year, he wrote an 11,000-word profile titled Azam the American, about Adam Gadahn, an al-Qaeda propagandist who recently has been indicted for treason. First person in more than 50 years, first American in more than 50 years to be indicted for treason. In spring of 2005, Rafi Khachaturian was a visiting fellow at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, where he investigated militant Islam and counterterrorism in North Africa. Rafi has contributed to the leading newspapers and journals in this country. He earned his BA from Trinity College in Hartford, where he started out, interestingly, as a double major in art and physics. It's an interesting story that maybe he'll tell how he led to his current research. But he earned his undergraduate degree at Trinity and then a master's degree in international relations from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Please welcome Rafi Khachaturian.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. A little multimedia segment for you, but I just want to start off, leave it to the Washington Post to give us a relevant story to talk about today, terrorists proving harder to profile. And there were just a few things that jumped out at me in this piece that I just thought would be interesting to mention. It starts off talking about a woman named Bukra El-Hur, and who was arrested in the Netherlands, and who had with her a number of materials that suggested that she was going to engage in some kind of jihadi activity. And one of her friends says, "We were flabbergasted to learn that she had become a fanatic. They recalled her as being a normal Dutch girl." And the piece has a number of other people who are mentioned in there, a guy named Jason Walters, who is the son of a US soldier, a woman named Muriel Dekak, who was a Catholic by upbringing, who grew up in Belgium, was a baker, and became a suicide bomber in Iraq. A guy named Nizar Trabalisi, who was convicted in Belgium in 2003 for plotting an attack on a NATO installation, and was a soccer star. And then finally, it mentions three of the subjects in the United Kingdom who were arrested for the transatlantic bombing plot, who were converts. They were from affluent families. One loved the movie Team America. I think there couldn't be a more relevant way of sort of getting into the story of Adam Gadahn, because what this piece points out is what a lot of other people are talking about, which is that there is a new kind of figure out there who is becoming interested in participating in global jihad, and they're not the kind of people who we normally expect. And I think Adam Gadahn is very much an example of that kind of person. So before I begin, I think we'll just try to get a sample of what Adam Gadahn is like. And I'm going to activate this for you. And I've queued it up. Just so you know, this is from a video that was released last year. It's called An Invitation to Islam. It's a very unusual video. That logo you see in the lower left-hand corner is As-Sahab, which is the logo of Al-Qaeda's main video production studio. This video was released just before Adam Gadahn was indicted for treason. And one of the important features of it, which you won't be seeing, is that he was introduced by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was, you could say, bin Laden's deputy, one of the senior members of Al-Qaeda. And Mr. Zawahiri opens the video by saying, "Adam Gadahn is a person that all Americans and all Westerners should listen to." And it's there are very few threats in this video. This is the only other thing that I should mention. It really is an attempt to ostensibly to persuade Americans to convert to the al-Qaeda ideology, or at least to explain its position. And there are other theories about why it was put together, but I won't go into all of them right now.
And the religion he taught us. But the fact is, God describes the unbelievers as ignorant throughout the Quran and tells us that they neither understand nor think. Indeed, one of the most dedicated and fiercest enemies of the Muslims was nicknamed Abu Jahl, father of ignorance. And what was true for the unbelievers of yesterday holds true for the so-called enlightened unbelievers of our time. I can't forget the day when, as I was praying a prescribed prayer with one of the brothers in a shopping center parking lot in suburban America, a man sped by in his sports utility vehicle, shouting from his open window, "Worship Jesus, your Lord." The gas guzzler, cell phone, and college diploma notwithstanding, one couldn't help but be reminded of Abu Jahl in the 7th century, abusing the Prophet while he prayed, because he worshipped God alone and rejected the idols of the Arabs.
So there you have what I call in the piece a sample of, I guess you could call it jihadlish, Adam Gadon's unique synthesis of jihadi rhetoric and his American experiences, or at least as he puts them forward. Okay, so we can talk more about that later. George, thanks. You introduced Adam Gadon for me a little bit. I'll just go a little bit into his background. He grew up in Riverside County, California. He converted to Islam at the age of 17, and he apparently joined al-Qaeda sometime in the late 1990s. He is at large. He is, as you can see, a propagandist for al-Qaeda, and he is believed to be living and working in a region of Pakistan called North Waziristan. He's appeared in at least 5 al-Qaeda videos that we know of, and has done other propaganda work that is unrelated to videos. And really the central questions of the piece and the central questions that involve all of these other people is why do they join this movement? And, you know, in Adam's case, where does his rage toward the United States come from? I'm going to start very briefly just with some terminology, because after this video came out, I was able to learn that it was posted on a website that people who are affiliated with al-Qaeda use to discuss, one of the password-protected jihadi chat rooms. And not long after it was released, I was informed by mail from someone who was sympathetic to that ideology about some thoughts were shared with me. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about this, and a lot of it was preoccupied with minutia that's not worth discussing, is that the person put the term radicalization, which I use throughout the piece, in quotes. And that got me thinking about that term, Islamic radicalization, which we use and journalists use, experts use, without really, I think, giving it too much thought. The term radical comes from that comes to English from Latin through the French, and it means of or pertaining to the root of things. And really, radical change obviously suggests a fundamental transformation of something. And the Oxford English Dictionary gives a number of glosses for the word, and in a political sense, radical means representing or supporting the extreme section of a political party. And so if you think about the term prior to September 11, how it's conventionally used, the idea of a left-wing radical suggests someone who has really gone to the very far end of a two-dimensional spectrum, someone whose ideas have passed the point by which they're no longer compatible with the power structure, someone who wants to overturn the root of something. Well, what's Islamic radicalization then? If an Islamic radical is someone whose beliefs are at the extreme end of some spectrum, what spectrum are we talking about? Is it religious? Is it political? Is it cultural? The answer is not really so straightforward, and it turns out that it's really a combination of all these things. Gallup, which has done some really interesting polling on on Islamic radicalization in recent years. They just recently did a study where they interviewed 10,000 people throughout the Middle East, defines the idea of a radical as someone who believes that the attacks on September 11 were justified and who holds some measure of anti-American sentiment. But I think that's a really, from an analytical perspective, even though I can understand why that's useful to them, it does pose some problems. The other way you could try to define the term is to go to Islamic radicals themselves. Fawaz Gerges, who's a scholar at Sarah Lawrence, who's done a number of interviews, met with a prominent Egyptian Islamist named Kamal el-Said Habib. And Kamal chastised Fawaz Gerges, who was trying to ascribe some kind of political or social explanation for why people joined the jihad. And the explanation that he gave was, "We did not sacrifice the flower of our youth, the best years of our life in prison to get jobs and earthly rewards. Our aim is to please God. The West cannot comprehend our spirituality and religiosity as long as it is blinded by materialism." And so by that definition, really an Islamic radical is just an intensely pious person, and that doesn't really suit our needs either. I'm just going to ask you to just keep in mind three sort of intersecting aspects of the concept as I go through Adam Gadahn's story. One is political disillusionment. To what extent does the person who we believe is an Islamic radical politically disillusioned? The other is sacred values. To what extent what are the sacred values held by this person? And thirdly, what's the imperative to act? That's a sort of a dispositional stance on the part of the Al-Qaeda or jihadist. And what that allows us to do is allows us to ask a number of questions. And as I go along, please keep them in mind. Okay, so Adam Gadahn. He was raised on a farm in Southern California, and it's a really stark and really beautiful part of the country. The farm is about 40 acres, and it sits on a beautiful set of hills. Adam Gadahn's mother was from Pennsylvania, and his father grew up in Orange County, California, and they settled on the property more than 25 years ago. They decided to raise goats, and they wanted to live self-sufficiently, and they had no running water, and they produced their own electricity. It's something I mentioned in the story, and it's worth pointing out that really they weren't people who were shunning technology so much as people who were living according to a very specific set of ideals. In fact, solar panels, when they first obtained them, were quite advanced technology. They didn't own a phone. They didn't have a mailing address. And they lived a life that was, I think, somewhat common in rural America. They were as close to their neighbors as they could have been, but they also very much lived their own lives. Adam Gadahn's story, as I point out in the piece, is in some sense generational, and perhaps everyone's story is. His father underwent a profound religious experience when he was a young man about Adam's age, and when I found out that this had made an impression upon Adam Gadahn, I felt it was something that I had to explore. Adam's father's name is Philip Perlman, and his father, Carl Perlman, was a prosperous physician, and his mother was a college teacher. And Philip Perlman, it's important to point out, was raised to believe in God, but it was in a non-denominational way. It was in a fairly secular way. His father was Jewish and his mother was Protestant. And it seems that religion in their household, to the extent that it found any overexpression, did not put much emphasis on doctrine or ritual. The Perlmans, it's important to point out, lived in Santa Ana, and they were an important part of their community. They helped build up local institutions, and they were involved in the arts. And one person told me that Adam's ancestry could be traced to the early days of the American Republic, in fact, and that some of his forebears had once held public office. This was a family that was and is very much part of the fabric of American life in their part of the country. So in the 1960s, while studying at the University of California at Irvine, Phil Perlman became quite well known. I was told that you could drive into Laguna Beach at that time and just ask where he was, and someone would probably be able to tell you. He was a prominent figure in the countercultural movement. He grew his hair long. He wore a beard. He became interested in civil rights issues and free speech. He played electric guitar and organized these sort of unstructured musical happenings. They were sort of improvisational jam sessions. And everyone who I spoke to about the father just referred to him as a gentle, peaceful soul. He had, I think, strongly held political, religious beliefs, but they were very private, and he wasn't evangelical about them. It's key, though, to point out that for Phil Perlman, Adam's father, his religious experience was kind of a transformational event. One day in the 1960s, he was walking along the shore, and he found a Bible that was open up, and he started reading through it. And as he began to read the Bible, he became aware of a divine presence that had an effect on him. And eventually, he began referring to religion in his music, and that's how we know something about his beliefs, because the Gadon family now does not really talk to the press, and I should say that I was unable to speak with Adam Gadon's family. But in these, in his music, we have a sense of what some of his beliefs were like. Phil Perlman saw the world as a vast Orwellian wilderness, as he described it in one of his songs at the time. And he believed that we all had to take a journey within this kind of harsh environment and achieve a kind of relative perfection in our own special tiny corner of the universe. He described the world's governments as too corrupt and power-obsessed to achieve peace in places like the Middle East, and that might have been somewhat consistent with where people were in the era of Watergate and the Vietnam War. And I don't know to what extent he carried those beliefs forward in time, but I got the sense that they were very profound for him. Not least because several years after this experience, he decided to change his name to Gadon. There was a refashioning of his entire identity that came as a result of it. Gadon is a reference to the biblical warrior Gideon. It's pronounced in Hebrew Gidon. And it's also worth to note that Adam, that not only did he adopt a new identity, but he refashioned Christianity to suit his spiritual needs. And this also made an impression upon Adam Gadon. His father, for instance, decided that the Trinity was not an aspect of Christianity that he wanted to believe in. When Adam was born, his parents gave him the middle name Yahya, which is an Arabic term, an Arabic name for John the Baptist, who's believed by Muslims to be a prophet. Adam was shy. He was bookish. He was very bright. His grandfather used to boast that he could read through the encyclopedia at the as early as the age of six. The Gadons homeschooled their children, but they also gave them opportunities to be social. Adam Gadon participated in Little League and Christian homeschool support groups. But interestingly, he didn't really connect with a lot of these people. He had some, there's some indication that he didn't really relate to them. And by the age of 15, on this isolated farm in Riverside County, he came up with his own way of reaching out to people. And I dwell on this a little bit in the piece, and I think it's worth mentioning. It involved a musical subculture called death metal, which I had to learn something about. And death metal, in fact, fans of death metal, in fact, discussed this piece at great length after it came out, and some of the most interesting discussions about it occurred on death metal websites. What is death metal? Death metal is a kind of music that's very harsh, it's very severe, it's very powerful, and it's very dark. Some of the vocals are meant to, they sound like this horrific growl, and people who mock it compare it to the sound of the Cookie Monster. The lyrics can be metaphysical, they can be aggressive, and they can employ medical terminology, and they focus, it seems, often on corporeal decay, on social decay. The musical side of it is very challenging to play. Some of the musicians were interested in classical music, and they borrowed things from both classical music and jazz. But the key thing to point out is that I think that its appeal is not so much its aggressiveness or its expression of rage, but its attempt to convey an experience to teenagers that is authentic, that is powerful. And I think that that's what Adam's interest in it was, and I think that's what a lot of teenagers' interest in it is. The other interesting thing about death metal was, if you go back to the 1990s, this is prior to the internet, and people who engaged in it were involved in a worldwide network of letter writing. And for Adam, this was really a way to get involved in what I would say is a very large, very intense, imagined community. This network, people told me, Adam was able to obtain hundreds of cassettes and writing to people as far away as Malaysia, as the Ukraine, as Bulgaria. So from his isolated farm, he found a group of sort of like-minded people, and their conversations and some of the letters that I obtained focused very much around the singular topic, around music, about whether it was sophisticated enough, about whether it was raw or real enough, whether it had obtained something, a level of authenticity that warranted listening and sharing. And the other thing that's interesting to note is that Adam Gadahn in these letters impressed people. He communicated with people who were far older than he was. And I was also always impressed by the amount of initiative that it took to sustain relationships around the world by mail. This is the kind of person who really wants to engage with the community, and he seeks out the people who he feels are important, and he tries to connect with them. I noticed a pattern in Adam's letters, which is that he sought people who were doing the work that he thought was most interesting, and he tried to befriend them. But I think an imagined community of this kind ultimately had its limitations, and I think Adam realized that too. He finished his high school coursework at the age of 16, and a year early, and he moved in with his grandparents in Santa Ana. And really, this is one of those transitional moments in a person's life where he really could have gone in any direction. Now, Adam, after his conversion to Islam, wrote that he experienced a kind of spiritual yearning, that there was a spiritual void that he wanted to fill, and that's how he ended up in Islam. Although researchers of conversion will tell you that often people reconstruct their histories after the fact into precisely that kind of narrative, the sense that there was a void that their new religion fills. So whether he was experiencing that to some degree or not, I don't know, but he ended up being exposed to Islam on the internet. And once he decided to commit to the religion, he started attending a mosque. He attended 5 days a week, every day, five times a day, and he eventually moved into an apartment with several other men around the mosque. And his entire life basically revolved around the activities of the mosque. I'm just going to say a few more things because this is really the final stages of this Adam Gadahn story, and then we can talk about the broader issues. This mosque at this time, it was the 1990s, was concerned with, there were various pressures on it that shaped the political atmospheres of the mosque. They were internal and they were external. And it's worth just thinking about that because this is the environment, this is the social milieu that Adam finds himself at this critical transitional moment. The external pressures, they happened all over the world, and they were part of things that Muslims in this country and elsewhere were concerned about worldwide. There was the wars in the 1990s, wars in Chechnya, in Bosnia, in Afghanistan, in Algeria, civil war, and of course the conflict in the Middle East. These were things that were object of concern to Muslims at the mosque, and they spoke about them in discussion groups, and they spoke about them at other times. The other external pressure is something that we don't often really think about, I think, and that is a few months before Adam Gadahn walked into that door in the Garden Grove Mosque, Timothy McVeigh blew up Oklahoma City building. And that had a tremendous impact on that mosque at that time. In the initial days before McVeigh was announced to be the perpetrator of that act of terrorism, it was widely circulated throughout the media that Muslims were responsible for that attack. And so in the days following, all kinds of death threats came to that mosque, and they felt embattled. And they invited the police to come and talk about security, and they built a security guard. And so when you read Adam's writings after his conversion, they express a kind of embattlement about this community that he has already adopted, one that has both a global and a local feature. Adam Gadon enters a religion that he seems to think already is to some extent under threat. And I think that's important. So, I mean, not only does he write about it, he actually gets a job as a security guard in the newly built guardhouse. In these discussion groups that occur on the fringe of the daily activity of the mosque, he also begins to be exposed to more political beliefs. He gets involved with two men, Hisham Diab and Khalil Deek, and both of them have broader connections to the world of jihad. Khalil Deek is a Palestinian, and he had close associations with a man in Pakistan called Abu Zubaydah. And eventually, Adam Gadon, with a group of several people, some of his compatriots from the discussion group, went to Pakistan. And eventually, he made his way through several al-Qaeda training camps, and his first act of propaganda, as far as we can tell, is the narration of an al-Qaeda video celebrating the attack on the USS Cole in 2001. So that's a compressed version of his story. The interesting thing for me is I started looking, once I was able to piece it together, at the kind of theories or models that we have to explain this phenomenon, to wonder whether Adam Gadon's case fit with our general understanding of that. And it turns out that there is a psychiatrist, a forensic psychiatrist named Mark Sageman, who worked for the CIA, who wanted to examine the phenomenon of Islamic radicalization in a systematic, empirical way. And what he did was he collected 172 case studies of people who he felt that there was enough information about to draw some conclusions about how they joined this broad social movement, what he called global Salafist jihad. And what he found was that, contrary to our expectations, there was a pattern. There wasn't a profile, and that really hasn't changed. I mean, that's the conclusion that he made, and that's the conclusion that you see in the Washington Post story. There isn't a psychological profile, but there is a pattern. And what Sageman found was that most of the people who joined the global Salafist movement did so from diaspora communities. I think he calculated at one point that 70% of the people who had done so were in diaspora communities. And he was only able to find one example, an example of an Afghan who joined al-Qaeda while al-Qaeda's base was in Afghanistan. Only one example of someone who had joined the movement while in the country that it was based in. So he found that this was a group of people who were largely raised in middle-class, upper-middle-class backgrounds, who were in a kind of exile status, who were in a transitional moment in their lives, and who congregated at mosques and spoke about religion in discussion groups that were much like the kinds that Adam Gadon were a part of. What he realized was that often, and by looking at other sort of new religious movements, what he realized is that often, as often the case, the desire to form social bonds with people who are in these transitional moments precedes their commitment to the ideals of those organizations. This isn't to say that they don't adopt them, but they are mainly drawn into the group through social networks. I think he calculated that as much as 75% of the people who were affiliated with al-Qaeda or the jihadi movement already had a family member or a friend who was part of it. And so these guys form these groups, and they form these groups that are what he called the halal theory of terrorism. Halal is what is permitted in Islam, and it often is a term that is used to describe dietary laws. And for Sageman, it was the discussions that happened over halal meals, where these kinds of things, where people were radicalized, almost in a process of one-upmanship. There was no brainwashing occurring. There was no recruiter, although there was what some analysts call an entrepreneur, someone who was able to link these groups, the bunch of guys, as Sageman calls them, from their small communities, wherever they are in Europe, and the occasional ones in the United States, to the broader movement. And I think that that model really does help understand what, help explain what Adam Gadahn's scenario was. And I think in my half hour limit, so I can keep going, or if you have any questions, let me know.
Go to questions and maybe cover some of the things. I'd like to invite those who have questions to come to the back of the room, and we'll be able to take them. Let me start off, Rafi, by thanking you for the presentation and by asking, how does one formally become a member of Al-Qaeda? If I were a young man who had gone through some stage of radicalization, what procedurally would I have to do? Are there standards that I'd have to meet? I think I've read that it's harder to get into Al-Qaeda than it is Harvard. What does one have to do in order to be accepted?
I don't know how Sageman calculated these numbers, but he said that that the number of trainees aspiring to get into Al-Qaeda was somewhere between 10% and 30%. But I should give a caveat here, because I think what Sageman is talking about is a sort of an earlier incarnation of the organization. Bin Laden had a bodyguard named Abu Jandal. And Abu Jandal gave a series of interviews to a newspaper based in London not long ago, in the past couple of years. And he said something that a lot of analysts, I think, believe now, which is that Al-Qaeda has, to some extent, become a movement. It has outgrown its status as an organization. There have been reports that the command and control of Al-Qaeda has reconstituted itself somewhat, but that doesn't change the fact that it has broadened itself to an ideology. So there are people who maybe are acting in the name of Al-Qaeda, in the spirit of Al-Qaeda, without holding a formal membership. I think that's what the Washington Post story is about, and that's to some extent some of the people who are most worrying about that most worry law enforcement officials. People who take it upon themselves, without any orders from anyone, to commit an act of terrorism. That said, in the earlier incarnation of Al-Qaeda, as we understand it, there was a formal oath that people took. It was an oath to bin Laden and to the movement. And I imagine that once you took that oath, you were a made member of the organization.
What are some of the standards that one might have to meet in order to come in?
I brought with me today, again, some of this is outdated, but I brought with me an Al-Qaeda training manual that kind of goes into this. They actually thought about the kind of people they wanted working for them. Now, this training manual, which again may very well be outdated, gives an order of about 10 or 15 points. And I'll just go through some of them. Islam, person must be a Muslim. Commitment to the organization's ideology. Interestingly, maturity, the ability to sacrifice. Listening and obedience, keeping secrets and concealing information, free of illness, patience, tranquility and unflappability, intelligence and insight, caution and prudence, truthfulness and counsel, ability to observe and analyze, ability to act. And they go into some detail in this manual to explain what some of those terms are. But they have a very clear idea of who they want. And what's fascinating is that they don't seem to be actively recruiting people. They allow people to come to them. And in a way, it is a way to filter out people who have these qualities, I think, even if they don't follow this manual to the letter anymore.
To what extent have you personally felt a change in your own outlook as a result of your studies in terms of religion or in politics?
Change in my own personal outlook?
Yes.
I don't know. That's hard to say. I spent most of my energies trying to really understand Adam Gaudin's story, and it was really a mosaic. It was really a puzzle, because without having gone to high school, trying to find friends, trying to find the social relationships that he had had, was quite a challenge. Going back in time, I have to say I had never really considered the degree to which events like the war in Bosnia or Chechnya, or more importantly, the Timothy McVeigh bombing, had on his life or on the life of Muslims who were, you know, sort of considering the direction they might be heading in at that time. So that was a kind of an eye-opening thing for me.
Could you say a little bit more about the anti-materialism? I mean, it's so obvious that when Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Centers, it was a statement against American capitalism, international capitalism. But could you reflect a little bit more on the anti-materialism masked by spirituality? I found that fascinating.
There's a very interesting anecdote that's given to us, it may be by Abu Jandal, I don't remember, about bin Laden in Afghanistan. And bin Laden was living actually quite frugally at the time. I think they had a very limited amount of money. And some member of the jihad came to bin Laden and asked for some money. I don't remember why. It was something very pragmatic that he wanted to do, perhaps visit his wife who was ill or you know, take care of his children. And bin Laden goes back into his residence and takes all the money that he has, and he gives it to the man, and he leaves. And the guy who recounts the story says that those who were surrounding bin Laden were upset about this. They wanted to know why he gave the final funds to one person who wanted to do something for his own life when that should have been used for the movement, for the jihad. And bin Laden replied, according to the story, that they would be taken care of somehow by God, and that he would eventually find a way to get more funds. And for a period of time, they ate dry bread and pomegranate seeds. And that story kind of stood out in my mind because it is part of, whether it's true or not, it is part of the mythology of Al-Qaeda. It is part of what helps establish its authenticity, the sense of a pious mission being furthered by this storyline that bin Laden, for whatever his wealth, has sacrificed all of that to the commitment of his ideals. So it's an important component of the mythology of Al-Qaeda.
Rafi, in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing, Timothy McVeigh was caught rather quickly, but not before false assumptions, as you mentioned, circulated throughout the country that this was the work of Islamic radicals. Let's turn the question around. To what extent can Islamic radicalism be used by domestic criminal elements to perpetrate their own acts of destruction and using Islamic radicalism as their excuse, their cover?
I really don't know of any known cases of that, so I really can't say much about it. Is it possible? I imagine anyone could mask criminal activity as anything else, but I would have to know, there would have to be some reason to do that, and because I don't know of any cases where that's occurred, I really can't say much about it.
Could you comment on the young woman who's from Somalia, I believe, and served in the Dutch parliament, whose name I can't remember? her view now, it leads me to believe that her view isn't just radical Islam that's dangerous and a threat, but there's something about the religion in general. I'd like your comment on that.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that view. And the sacred values that I mentioned earlier that buttress this global Salafist movement, this militant movement, are values that have been evolved over a careful process that began, you know, in the 1970s. There were opposition movements in Egypt who made theological arguments to support some of the things that they were doing. And they're very much apart from what the mainstream Muslims believe.
Yes, the issue of violence and with Al-Qaeda, what are they attempting to accomplish? Do they want to kill us all?
When Ayman al-Zawahiri was in prison in the early 1980s in Egypt, there's a fascinating video clip. He became the spokesman for a number of prisoners who were put into jail, and he was captured on video explaining what this movement was about. And there's one term that he said that always stood out for me in my mind, which is, we are here. And I think there's to some extent in which acts of terrorism are really acts of propaganda. They are declarations, we are here. And that's part of their strategic objective. Yes, they cause a lot of damage, and yes, they murder a lot of people. But the nature of that is to both incite their supporters and to instill fear in their perceived enemies. And understood from that point of view, terrorism is about creating a storyline. It is an act of propaganda, and I think that that is part of what they're trying to achieve.
When you were researching Azam's story, I'm sure you contacted the leader of his mosque, but I imagine you also contacted the leaders of many other mosques in the United States. Could you comment on what is their reaction towards Al-Qaeda? What are they doing about it, either one way or another?
I didn't have time to do a broad review of what imams across the country have to say about Al-Qaeda. But I did have discussions with the imam at Adam Gadon's mosque, he's a man named Muzamil Siddiqui, and he told me that he believes that Adam Gadon has gone against the things that he hoped to instill in his community. Muzamil Siddiqui, by the way, gave an official prayer 4 or 5 days after September 11 at President Bush's invitation, and later visited President Bush in the Oval Office, handed him a Quran, and said that Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with what was in that book. Again, though, you have to go back in time. In the 1990s, the term jihad had different connotations. I spoke with the imam. I asked him to define jihad for me in its political sense. And he told me that he said that it was the pursuit of social justice. It is to defend your faith when it is attacked. And you can see how in the 1990s, when these various wars were unfolding, that could be one way to understand the concept, which is more traditional than the way I think Al-Qaeda defines it.
Rafi, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the craft of the journalist in a situation like this where your sources are obscure and uncooperative. Could you tell us sort of how you put the piece together from start to finish? Interesting piece of detective work, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, there were basically three or four areas that required, and they were completely separate from each other because Adam Gadon lived a very compartmentalized life. Trying to find the people in the pen pal network was a wholly separate activity from trying to get to know people in Adam Gadon's mosque. And that, at the same time, was very different from trying to get members of Adam Gadahn's family to help or participate in some way. Fortunately, because Adam Gadahn was so prolific and so memorable to so many people in the Pen Pal network, I basically followed that like a chain. And it also helped that once I figured out that he was writing to people who he respected, basically any time I found out that he liked a particular band, I got in touch with them. And often was the case that he had written to them. So his pen pals were people who he had written about in a more casual kind of way. And that was basically a process of following the chain. At the mosque, it took, again, quite a bit of effort because there's a lot of concern about talking about issues related to terrorism. If you are American and you are a Muslim, and you want to be careful about what you say, and there are a lot of fears about talking about such sensitive issues. So that also required a fair amount of work.
What were your efforts to make contact with members of the family, and what was their response, and have you had any contact with them since the piece appeared?
Yeah, I mean, Adam Gadahn's mother and father, Adam Gadahn first surfaced in connection to terrorism in 2004. And what the FBI had said at that point was that he was wanted for questioning. And at that moment in 2004, Adam Gadahn's mother, actually his father really, I don't think his mother has ever said anything to the press, came forward, his aunt came forward, and they basically tried to remind the press that being wanted for questioning wasn't an accusation of guilt. Once it became clear that Adam Gadahn was presumed to be guilty by the authorities, I think his family stopped seeing any reason to communicate with the press. And I think that their own pain in the matter began to become more realized. And so they stopped talking, and they didn't talk to me either. So I would have liked to have talked to them, but at the same time, I wanted to respect their privacy.
As I recall, the term treason is very carefully defined in the U.S. Constitution. I think that's where it is. So I'm curious, since it's such a rare charge in the history of our republic, exactly what was the procedure for charging this man with treason, and how did they do it? What's the basis? What's the terminology? You get the picture.
I spent some time talking with the Department of Justice about how they arrived at the treason charge. And since they do plan to bring this to court at some point, they're very careful about talking about how they arrived at that specific charge. So they weren't much revealing about that. But I spoke with some outside analysts who didn't illustrate that treason is something that allies in the war on terrorism can understand. You can go to Pakistan and say this guy is wanted as a traitor, and there's an understanding of what that means. Whereas to say this guy is wanted as a material witness, it's a little more vague. So from, I guess, a political perspective, there's some utility in identifying him as an accused traitor.
Could you reflect or offer observation on, is there the relationship, the impact that the power of fundamentalist extreme Christianity has on the growing awareness, rise of radical Islam?
That's not something that I really looked in at all. And I mean, if there are connections between Christian fundamentalism and Islamic fundamentalism, it's just not something I'd feel too competent to talk about. It is an interesting question, though.
Apropos that question, I heard a talk the other day by a gentleman who is very much involved on the national level with education. And he was speaking about homeschooling. And, of course, you can tie in the evangelical movement largely with homeschooling, and also the Muslim groups, because apparently Muslims have gone into a very strong regime of homeschooling. And this is sort of, in their case, helped defer integration into the American society. I wonder if you would comment about the homeschooling that this young man had, and as compared to the homeschooling that the Muslims get today, and tell us what you think about this movement.
It's hard to say too much definitively about it, since Adam Gadahn's parents didn't participate in the piece. But it does seem that his homeschooling meant that his social network prior to leaving home was more or less confined to his family and the year he spent in Little League, where he didn't really gel too well, and the Christian support groups, which he later derided. And so the upshot of that was that he found this other imagined community to be a part of, the correspondence network of this musical subculture. And so I think that was an important... I think it is important in so much as he approached the mosque when he did come to that point in his life, almost as a kind of internal exile. But I really don't want to criticize Adam Gadahn's parents. You know, one of the things that happened after John Walker Lind came to national attention was that there was a lot of criticism heaped on his parents for being overly permissive. In fact, for a brief period, John Walker Lind was homeschooled as well. And I really don't think that's what's being activated here in these two cases. There are other things at play, and I hope that in what I described, that comes through. Adam Gadahn, you know, despite being homeschooled, spent, you know, a lot of time, he traveled the country with his aunt. He went to Sweden with her, participated in some of the environmental work that she did, and, you know, had, from all accounts, a sense of morality about him, which was to some extent activated and perverted when he eventually made his way into the hands of Al-Qaeda.
You started out, Rafi, by saying that there were three elements of radicalization, and you asked us to keep those in mind. I wonder if you would close by describing the convergence of those in the case of Adam Gadahn.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see all those elements in that case, and you see it in other cases as well. Adam Gadahn is the kind of person who really took initiative. He was described to be someone who was lonely, but who really wasn't preoccupied with his loneliness, but more concerned about what was going on in the world around him, the urbanization that was occurring, the urban sprawl that was spreading across Southern California. And so you see that in his letter writing, he's someone who took initiative, who was interested in, despite his circumstances, to become a part of something. But you also see that, and then you see in his adoption of sacred values, he eventually adopts the sacred values of jihad, and you can see somewhat over the course of the time that he spends at the mosque, he enters this community that is embattled, that has, you know, what some might say, legitimate fears or concerns that then eventually become intensified and become supported by a religious framework. And then there's a kind of political disillusionment. For whatever reason, Adam Gadahn did not see fit to engage the society that he was a part of in a way that was part of the political process. He felt excluded from that. Again, I can't really say why. He grew up in a household that at least his father, you know, again, had some of the values that from the 1960s where government was held with some level of suspicion, and perhaps that was part of the fabric of his family life. I don't know. I can't say for sure. But he had some level of disillusionment about being part of the political process. And I think all those came together in his story to sort of express what the model suggests.
Early this morning, I received an email from a friend of the Miller Center, Lawrence Wright, who wrote the book, The Looming Tower, that was a history of the events leading up to 9/11. And Lawrence Wright's book was thought by most people to be one of the best books on the global war on terror and the history of Al-Qaeda. And it said very simply, please give my best to Rafi. He's a brilliant young journalist. The people in the journalist profession have hailed this article as a great first major piece by a brilliant young journalist. And we're thankful that Rafi was here with us today. Thank you.